You're listening to The Space Show on 88.3 Southern FM. I'm Andrew Rennie. When President Obama came to office, he was faced with a problem. Outgoing President Bush's Moon, Mars and Beyond policy was in deep trouble. The linchpin of Moon, Mars and Beyond was the Constellation program. Under development were a series of rockets called Ares, based partly on space shuttle booster technology. These rockets were to lift into space vehicles called Orion that would take humans back to the moon. The problem was the Constellation program was never properly funded. It could never achieve its goals with the money Congress had allocated. It was obvious to Obama that an alternative had to be set in place, one that could allow advances in spaceflight at a reasonable cost. Constellation was scrapped and a new direction was set. In early 2010, Obama proposed a new budget with different priorities. By 2010 April, the changes were emerging, so I decided to travel to the Kennedy Space Center to learn about them at first hand. On April the 8th, NASA's Administrator Charlie Bolden was ready to announce what NASA's future would be under the Obama administration. In a NASA-wide teleconference, NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden and his deputy Lori Garber laid out what each NASA center would do. NASA is not just one center. In addition to its Washington headquarters, it runs specialized centers around the nation. Most of you will have heard of the Kennedy Space Center, which is located at Cape Canaveral in Florida. You have probably heard of the Johnson Space Center in Clear Lake, Houston. In the following announcement, you'll hear of other centers referred to by their names: Goddard, Stennis, Glenn, Ames, Marshall, JPL, and so forth. Many of these centers are in fact named after people involved in the early development of spaceflight, either on the engineering side or else on the political side. Now, compere for the proceedings was Bob Jacobs, a public affairs officer from NASA HQ.
Thank you very much, and thank all of you for joining us. Most of you know me, Bob Jacobs with the Office of Communications, and we'll kind of be directing the traffic here this afternoon. With us today are NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden, NASA Deputy Administrator Lori Garber. We also have with us our Chief Technologist Bobby Braun, and the heads of our four mission directorates, Bill Gerstenmaier, Associate Administrator for Space Operations, Doug Cook, Associate Administrator for Exploration, Ed Weiler, Associate Administrator for Science, and Jaewon Shin, Associate Administrator for Aeronautics. After our speakers are done, we'll take questions. Each media outlet is allowed, for right now, for timing purposes, one question and a follow-up, and if we have additional time, we'll come back for more questions. If we're unable to get to everyone with a question, our email contact information is available at nasa.gov. More detailed information about the center program assignments is also available now on our website, www.nasa.gov/budget. And for now, let me turn over the floor to Charlie and Lori.
Bob, thanks very much. Good afternoon and welcome to all of you on the line. Today, Lori and I want to present NASA's outline for the program assignments across the nation in support of President's fiscal year 2011 budget request. What we will discuss today is new or extended work under the President's plan. It's important for all of you to note at the start that the new programs discussed here are contingent on congressional approval of the fiscal year 2011 budget and the President's signature of that budget into law. This budget provides an increase to NASA at a time when funding is scarce. It will enable us to accomplish inspiring exploration, science, and R&D, the kinds of things the agency has been known for throughout its history. The new budget enables NASA to set its sights on destinations beyond Earth orbit and develop the technologies that will require that will be required to get us there, both with humans and robots. We're talking about technologies that the field has long wished we had, but for which we did not have the resources. These are things that don't exist today, but that will make real the coming years. This budget enables us to plan for a real future in exploration with capabilities that will make amazing things not only possible, but affordable and sustainable. And because the President believes in space exploration and thinks that it's vital to our future as a nation and for creating jobs today, he will visit Florida next week to speak to the space community. We are very excited to host him on the Space Coast.
thanks, Charlie. This is Lori. These assignments do build on a deep knowledge and expertise that NASA has developed over 5 decades. They recognize our workforce's wealth of experience and commitment and the specialties already existing at the NASA Field Center. So they expand on the strengths of each center. A lot of this upcoming work overlaps at the centers, as we all share so many strengths in spaceflight, science, and aeronautics. So keep in mind that even though a program office is based at one center, the work of each program is often a NASA-wide effort. While we're still working on the specific numbers of employees that would be assigned to new program offices and activities, these assignments will make the new direction tangible and help everyone to understand the depth and scope of the President's vision for our future. The detailed center-by-center fact sheets are on our Internet homepage.
Let us begin today's presentation with the Johnson Space Center. The new flagship technology demonstrations program office will reside in Houston, and if approved by Congress, will manage $424 million in fiscal year 2011 and $6 billion over the next 5 years, along with the deputy manager at Kennedy, to demonstrate transformational technologies for next-generation spaceflight capabilities. At least 3 demonstrations will be initiated in fiscal year 2011, and most of these flight projects will involve collaborations among NASA centers, industry, and or with academia. Johnson also has the deputy manager for commercial crew development, and we'll discuss Kennedy's role as the program office in a minute. As you know, we will be greatly increasing our activities in this area with a goal of creating multiple paths for access to low Earth orbit. If approved, Johnson will see an increase in funding for the human research program, an area essential to our understanding of human health issues in long-duration spaceflight and habitation in space. This augments an existing program with an additional $63 million in fiscal year 2011, an increase of 42%, and $317 million over 5 years. As we've discussed since the new budget was released earlier this year, the new proposal adds more than $3 billion over 5 years to extend the International Space Station's operations, likely to 2020 or beyond. We see this as an investment critical to bringing ISS to its full potential as an international laboratory. The proposal adds $312 million for additional commercial cargo work to possibly accelerate the COTS commercial cargo milestones.
Now I'll talk about the Kennedy Space Center. In the FY11 budget request, KSC is taking on significant new responsibilities and receiving significant upgrades that will make a Florida Launch Center ready to prosper in the 21st century. Kennedy will host the Commercial Crew Development Program Office for this important facet of our upcoming work to open an entirely new segment of the economy. If approved, the new program office manages $5.8 billion over 5 years, with the deputy program manager, as Charlie just mentioned, at Johnson, to foster private sector transportation services to and from Earth orbit. The new 21st Century Launch Complex Program Office at Kennedy will manage $429 million in FY11 and $1.9 billion over 5 years to modernize KSC's facilities, to reduce launch costs, not only for NASA, but for other users. The goal is to augment NASA's current and future operations to achieve safe, increased operational efficiency, and reduce launch costs for all customers. We also want to facilitate multiple launches of different types of vehicles from different companies, carrying both humans and cargo in a timely fashion. So in concert with Johnson, Kennedy will have the deputy manager for flagship technology demonstrations to help manage this key aspect of our new efforts to provide future explorers with many more capabilities than we have today. And finally, the budget also provides an extra quarter of a year of shuttle funding. As you know, one of our top priorities is to safely fly out the remaining shuttle manifest, even if it requires moving into the next fiscal year.
Now let's talk a little bit about Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. We plan to establish a new heavy lift and propulsion research and development program office to manage $559 million in fiscal 2011 and $3.1 billion over 5 years to develop next-generation engines and propulsion technologies. Our aim is to reduce costs and shorten development timeframes for future heavy lift and in-space systems. Building on Marshall's experience managing the Lunar Precursor Robotic Program, the center will manage a new Exploration Precursor Robotic Program, office to manage approximately $105 million in fiscal 2011 and $2.6 billion over the five-year period for robotic missions to the Moon, Mars and its moons, Lagrange points, and nearby asteroids to scout targets for future human activities. If Congress approves, we'll establish a new Space Technology Demonstrations Program office to manage $75 million in fiscal 2011 and $1.4 billion over 5 years to oversee flight testing of cross-cutting aerospace technologies with a potential to benefit multiple NASA mission directorates, other government agencies, or the space industry. There is a new Centennial Challenges Program office to manage $10 million in fiscal 2011 and $5 million over 5 years for this innovative prize program that helps push forward the cutting edge of technologies we'll need in the future. As many of you know, we've already had some amazing results with precision landing, astronaut gloves, and regolith excavation, and are now looking at power beaming, strong tethers, and many other areas.
Moving on to Stennis, we're going to use their expertise in propulsion testing of large-scale rocket engines, subsystems, and components using its unique capabilities in rocket engine test facilities for first stage and upper stage engine research as part of the $3.1 billion program. Stennis will increase partnerships with commercial market customers, building upon current engine testing planned for commercial vehicles we have ongoing as part of NASA CRS and COTS program.
Now let's take a little time to talk about the Ames Research Center in California. As part of the Exploration Precursor Robotic Program, the Exploration Scouts program focuses on small, competed robotic precursor missions to the Moon, Mars and its moons, Lagrange points and nearby asteroids to scout targets for future human exploration. Using Ames's existing base of knowledge, we'll establish a small satellite subsystem technology program, a new research and development program in this important area with $6 million in fiscal 2011 and $126 million over 5 years. We'll look at things such as formation flying, long-life power systems, miniaturized remote sensors, autonomous swarm operations, and other technology enablers. In creating the Edison Small Satellite Demonstrations Program, we'll demonstrate key small satellite capabilities and give students the opportunity for hands-on experience. If approved, we'll spend $10 million in fiscal 2011 and $90 million over 5 years to develop and operate a series of NASA-focused small satellite demonstration missions to focus on the life and physical sciences. Increased funding for aeronautics activities will improve our green aviation and next-generation air transportation system, known as NextGen, capabilities. The aim is to make air travel safer, cleaner, and more efficient.
So moving on to the Glenn Research Center in Cleveland, the Exploration Technology Development and Demonstration Program is a key area which will manage $223 million in 11 and $1.8 billion over 5 years to mature key exploration technologies through laboratory, ground, and flight tests. Projects are likely to focus on high-power electric propulsion, autonomous precision landing, in-situ resource utilization, human robotic systems, including operating robots from orbit, and fission surface power systems. If approved, we'll also create a new Space Technology Research Grants Program Office at Glenn to manage $70 million in fiscal year 2011 and $350 million over the 5 years to support foundational research and graduate studies in key aeronautics-related disciplines. The program is designed to meet NASA's future space science and exploration needs, as well as the needs of the government, other government agencies and the commercial space sector through technological innovation. Finally, increased funding for aeronautics activities will build on Glenn's longstanding experience in this area.
Let's take a look at the Langley Research Center in Virginia. We'll create a new game-changing development program office to manage $124 million in fiscal 2011 and $1.5 billion over 5 years to foster innovative research and development projects that have the potential to revolutionize spaceflight. Research and development teams will be held accountable for ensuring that discoveries move rapidly from the laboratory to application through fixed-duration awards. Their work is capability-oriented, which differs from traditional R&D methods that advance discipline or core knowledge. A number of Earth science missions will be developed at Langley to help us learn more about our planet and help us better understand its changes. Sage 3 will provide near-global long-term measurements of key components of Earth's atmosphere. Clario is designed to make precision, stable measurements to enable rapid detection of long-term changes in the climate system. And venture-class missions will be smaller, competitive missions designed to get off the drawing board sooner. There's additional funding provided for aeronautics activity as we look at the Dryden Flight Research Center.
If approved by Congress, the new Flight Opportunities Program Office will manage $17 million in FY 2011 at Dryden and $85 million over 5 years to provide flight opportunities for cutting-edge research. This program will oversee two existing NASA projects, the Commercial Reusable Suborbital Research, or CRUSER, project, and the Facilitated Access to the Space Environment for Technology, FAST, project, which will provide flight opportunities for science, technology, development, and education efforts. Dryden also will see increased funding for aeronautics activities, with some of the research there to include advanced simulation and testing capabilities.
The President has made climate change research a priority. He also believes in NASA and other agencies' capabilities to improve our air travel system. The new direction enhances NASA's scientific exploration of climate change and provides resources for next-generation aeronautics systems. We will accelerate launch of key Earth science missions and pursue greener and more capable aeronautics technologies. Goddard, JPL, Ames, Glenn, Langley, and Dryden will play key roles in these accelerated programs. Let's talk a little bit now about Goddard and JPL. We'll continue to take advantage of Goddard's deep expertise in science and robotic missions that help us make discoveries about our home planet and the universe, including a new NASA-NOAA partnership to procure several of the nation's polar orbiting weather satellites. The Joint Polar Satellite Systems Program is important to civil and military weather forecasting, storm tracking, and climate monitoring. The fiscal year 2011 budget proposal accelerates four of the Decadal Survey Tier 1 missions recommended by the National Research Council. Goddard will lead ISAT-2 and participates in portions of both Clario and Destiny. Goddard also manages the Earth Systematic Missions Program, which contains the Decadal Survey missions.
So finally, let's look at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. JPL has astounded the world many times, not only with its planetary missions, but with the discoveries of the Earth-observing satellites it develops and manages. So we're going to focus here on its new Earth missions. After the heartbreaking loss of the orbiting carbon observatory on launch last year, the President has given us a second chance to launch this satellite, critical to our understanding of global carbon emissions. As we mentioned earlier, if approved by Congress, the budget enables all four of the Decadal Survey Tier 1 missions recommended by the National Research Council. JPL will lead SMAP development, which will measure global soil, moisture, and freeze-thaw cycles at high altitudes, and Destiny, which will measure ice sheet velocities and quantify biomass to help understand the global carbon cycle. This budget supports augmented climate continuity missions with the development of a GRACE follow-on mission to meet an important scientific need for continuity of key climate observations to help us understand our changing home planet. So that's it for the center activities that are specific. As you can see, we've got a very exciting and full portfolio. An essential role for all of us at NASA will continue to be not only innovating and helping the nation reap the benefits of that innovation, but inspiring our children and our future leaders to dream big and start on the dreams that it may require generations to achieve. There are lots of opportunities for partnerships between the NASA centers and with industry, academia, and other government agencies.
That's right, Lori. I hope everyone can see that we're expanding the frontier of exploration in ways that are beyond the wildest dreams of the early space pioneers. There are many great opportunities here for NASA and for the nation, and there are many proud moments ahead for all of us. Again, I want to thank all of our NASA workforce, both contractor and civil servant, for its commitment to this agency, its hard work, and its sacrifices. NASA's future is bright, thanks to your creativity and belief in the future. So that we can handle your questions.
And that was a teleconference on the reassignment of NASA center responsibilities to meet the challenges of the post-shuttle era or period. It was held while I was at the Kennedy Space Center on April the 8th last year. More about NASA's future in a moment.
here. If you're like me and sort of on the wrong side of 50, love your music, and you're wondering where all the John Bonhams, Rick Wakemans and Eric Claptons are of the new century, they're on Rockdown Radio. New songs of today, both Aussie and international. Listen to me 4 till 6 Thursday afternoons at 88.3 Southern FM. Rockdown rocks.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's special, we are at the Kennedy Space Center, where the topic is the future of NASA in the wake of the budget announcements made by President Obama. Now, there had been a great deal of media speculation on the wrongs of the NASA centers leading up to Bolden and Garber's announcements. NASA workers were also anxious about their job security. For example, just 1 month before, at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, John Shannon was asked about this time of uncertainty for his workforce. Now, Shannon is the manager of the Space Shuttle program.
I'd like to say a word about the workforce. It's a time of some uncertainty and some instability with the agency and in the aerospace field, as you all know. What I have told the team and what the senior leadership of the shuttle program has told the team is that the best thing they can do is exactly what they're doing, is process and perform as expected. They're providing a level of stability to this agency and to the nation for human spaceflight, and just to keep that up. We do workforce surveys fairly frequently and try to gauge the level of unrest or uncertainty within the workforce, and we have not seen any kind of an uptick in the attrition rates. We have not seen any issues with ground performance problems. There haven't been additional issues as we're doing our buildup of the stacks. Primarily, the most significant comment I get from the workforce surveys that we do is we would like to stop doing workforce surveys and just concentrate on the job at hand. So maybe we're over investigating a little bit, but we like to make sure that we have the tools in place to understand the issues that are out there.
Now, Shannon was also asked about the impact of closing the Space Shuttle program on NASA's industrial suppliers. He sought to clear up a wide-held misconception about suppliers of Space Shuttle parts.
There's a big misconception out there, I think, and that's on the shuttle supply chain, and that, you know, they're all out of business because we're ending the program, and you know, to get them back would be this enormous effort. It is not like there are small companies or small businesses out there that made, you know, shuttle widget number 5, and now that we're not flying the shuttle anymore, they're out of business and they've gone on to retirement in Florida, and we'll never hear from them again. For the most part, our suppliers and vendors are major companies in the aerospace field, maybe in all kinds of other fields. Take, for example, the orange foam that is robotically sprayed on the external tanks. That is produced by a company called North Carolina Foam Industries. They're a huge player in commercial and retail insulation. They do medical things. The shuttle program is a very small part of their business. And because the shuttle is going out of business does not mean that those companies are gone. There's this misconception that there's all this big supply chain that was shuttle specific only. Shuttle is for the most part a sideline business for these major companies that support the actual program.
Now, one of the questions that came up time and time again while I was at the Kennedy Space Center, could the space shuttle be kept flying? And what was the precise nature of the next manned spacecraft?
The next question comes from Seth Bornstein from the Associated Press.
Yes, thanks for doing this. For General Bolden, in terms of the opposition from Congress, and not just Congress, it is your predecessors as NASA administrators, as people like Chris Kraft, Jim Lovell, and the like, they say essentially you are killing the manned space program. They say that it makes no sense, that there's going to be nothing left. Do you feel that you haven't explain this well? I mean, you're saying you keep looking for words, and in doing so, you were tripping over words for at least a minute and a half on how to explain this. Is this too complicated to explain, as in three words, like Apollo on steroids? And I have a follow-up, of course.
Seth, I'm trying to remember where I was tripping over my words there for a minute and a half, but anyway, you know, Chris is, for example, Chris Kraft is an incredible mentor of mine. I talk to him over coffee quite a bit, and like any other mentor, the good thing is we can agree to disagree. I think we have explained pretty well the program. It's different, and that's what people need to understand. It's different in the way that its vision is to be enacted. It involves commercial entities in a way that we've not chosen to do in the past, or we've not had the courage to do in the past. And I think the other thing that's so different about it is, you know, it really reaches out and realistically talks about going to Mars, a place that we've always wanted to go, but it recognizes that there's a lot of technological development between here and there. And so I think everybody understands that.
And to follow up, if you think everyone understands that, why do you think so many are, especially in Congress, are saying you're ending NASA's manned space program, ceding it over to the Chinese or the Russians, or I think it was Congressman Culberson said, you know, killing off NASA's mission of going where no man has gone before, which I know is not really is Star Trek and not NASA. Why are so many people getting the impression you're killing off NASA manned spaceflight?
Seth, I'm gonna, at the risk of being controversial, with all due respect to everybody who you list as opponents to the budget, a very serious and real concern for everyone is the jobs. You know, but this is what we call progress. Unfortunately, if you look at every area of technology in this country, as you advance, there are fewer and fewer manual type jobs. That's what happens when you advance technology. We are doing everything that we can in our power. That's the reason we went through these new program offices with you today, is to help everybody understand that we're expanding the amount of programs that we have so that we can try to put people to work who are interested in being a part of the space program. So are we going to be able to employ everybody that used to work in shuttle? No, we're not, but that was never a vision. Even with the Constellation program, I think you saw that we were going to lose several thousand jobs because Constellation was a step farther than Shuttle. And the program that we envision now is a step farther than Constellation. But I think that is a significant issue for people.
Seth, thank you.
Thank you.
Operator, we're ready for the next question.
One of the main thrusts of President Bush's Moon, Mars, and Beyond policy was getting humans onto the surface of Mars. What? Many were now wondering, would be the prospects of Mars landings under the new space plans.
Hello, this is Alan Boyle with MSNBC. I think one of the criticisms that people have had about the current vision is the lack of a destination. And so I'm assuming that the president's talk next week will help fill in some of that. But has this work plan been arranged to reflect a specific new destination, or can you shed any more light on how the centers are prepared to go in a new direction?
Yeah, you know, I think if you look at everything that we've done over the past many years, and I'll let others in the room comment on this, the ultimate goal has always been Mars, and we just have not had the technological capability to get there. I've got my new chief technologist, Dr. Bobby Braun from Georgia Tech, on the line also. And Bobby, if you'd like to try to talk a little bit about how we plan to get to this destination and others, would you do that?
Sure, Charlie. So sending humans to Mars is perhaps one of the most challenging endeavors technologically that I can imagine. We obviously need new launch systems that can lift much larger payloads. We need to have learned from our on-orbit assembly of the International Space Station on how to assemble large, complex spacecraft. We need new advanced propulsion technologies to shorten the transit time, to limit the risk of humans during the duration of the in-space travel. We need to learn how to shield and protect our human astronauts during that transfer. And we actually don't know how to land a significantly large amount of payload on the surface of Mars today. We know how to land perhaps golf cart size or even small car size payloads, but we certainly don't know how to land a two-story house on the surface of Mars, particularly a two-story house right next to another two-story house that was sent ahead to prepare the way. So there are a wide range of technologies that need to be advanced to enable humans to go to that particular destination. As you back off and consider other destinations, for instance, the moon, asteroids, the Martian moons, we don't need all of those technological advances. But for our ultimate vision, we certainly need an investment in technology.
Got a follow-up?
That from what you were saying, it sounds as if Johnson Space Center is going to be the lead center for those sorts of technologies, and so the implication would be that Johnson is the one that's in the driver's seat, so to speak, when it comes to figuring out how to get to Mars.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. You know, this is a collaborative effort, and as we tried to explain in talking about the program offices, if you can imagine a virtual program office, the way that we ran the Constellation program, the program office was at the Johnson Space Center, the deputy manager was at Marshall Space Flight Center. Today, when we have meetings, there are frequently video teleconferences, and we can have people all over the country, if not all over the world. The way that we operate with our international partners on the International Space Station, you know, we have people in representing five different organizations, and they talk to each other in a meeting every single day to coordinate how you deal with problems, how you deal with issues, and where we're going in the future. So while Johnson has the flagship demonstration program office, that by no means indicates that there is no one in the driver's seat, so to speak.
In the 1960s, NASA developed a heavy lift rocket as part of its Apollo to the Moon project. That vehicle was abandoned in 1973. Indeed, the last three of them lie as museum pieces at the Kennedy, Johnson, and Marshall Space Centers. A heavy lift vehicle is one that can boost craft in of many tons mass into interplanetary space. Under Constellation, Ares 5 was to have been the heavy lift vehicle. So what now were NASA's plans for heavy lift?
The next question comes from Mark Kaufman of Washington Post.
Thank you very much. The first question has to do with, is there anything in what you're saying today that makes more clear or gives more money to the heavy lift component? Again, the critics have said, you know, going to LEO is one thing, but we need to have some way to get beyond. And the administration has said, yes, that is the plan. Can you point us to in what ways that is the plan here? And is there more money as a result?
There's, if you talk about money dedicated to heavy lift and propulsion, it's significantly more. In 2011, it's $559 million, and then it's $3.1 billion over a five-year period of time. So that's just dedicated to heavy lift and propulsion technology. When we talk about capturing nuggets from Constellation, we learn quite a bit from the Ares 1X flight, so there will be some things that we can learn from that. And although we weren't very far along on Ares 5, there are all kinds of lessons to be learned. Somebody has a real hot mic.
Yeah, Mark, I think that's you.
That's me?
I think that's you breathing.
The heavy breathing.
And typing.
No, I'm not breathing.
Okay. Anyway, let me try to get this answer out real quick since you're holding your breath. But I think you're going to see much more money directly focused on development of heavy lift propulsion technology and down the road, you know, involvement of academia and industry in ways that we did not do before to help us try to find out if there are new things out there, if there are new types of material that lighten. You know, you keep hearing us talk about heavy vehicles. Weight, mass is a big problem for spaceflight. So, you know, we're hoping that industry and academia, with these funds that we're going to make available, will help us find, you know, some new materials that we can use in engines, not in the vehicles themselves.
Okay.
One major change the Obama space policy brings about is to open the way for private enterprise to develop spaceships that would carry astronauts and cargo to low Earth orbit. This is where the International Space Station lies, around 400 kilometres above the Earth's surface. One question us reporters wanted to know was who would fly those new spaceships? Government, that is NASA, astronauts or civilian company astronauts?
With the astronaut office based in Houston and the commercial crew office in Kennedy, I'm just curious how that split will develop as new spacecraft come online, and if there is the potential for a commercial crew astronaut office in Florida. Thanks.
You know, what we're trying to do right now is develop a concept of operations for commercial crew activities. There is, and let me give you my vision, okay, and that's that'll be one person. I've got 12 people sitting around the table. If anybody else wants to add, they can, or anybody else out there. There are a couple of things we do. In NASA, we provide astronauts for exploration. A lot of that exploration and experimentation today and in the future will be done on the International Space Station. So what we are doing is relying on commercial capability to get us access to low Earth orbit, to get us to the International Space Station. But to get to places like the Moon and Mars and other beyond LEO places, that we feel is the responsibility of your government, because that's risky. That's an investment that we can't really count on a commercial entity taking until we've demonstrated the ability to do that and do it safely. So the astronaut office of the present and the astronaut office of the future will continue to be dedicated to the experimentation and the research that's needed for us to develop future commercial programs that we can hand off, but to carry out our NASA research programs. We don't see, at least I don't envision, a significant change in the way that we train, fly, and operate a standard NASA mission, whether it's on the International Space Station or anywhere else. So that activity will remain in Houston. The bulk of the work for the commercial crew actually deals with vehicle processing, vehicle purchasing, or acquisition, and the work with the commercial contractors themselves, since we want, or we expect, that they will all launch humans out of the Kennedy Space Center complex.
Thank you. Thank you very much, operator. We're ready for the next question.
Doug Cook is Associate Administrator for Exploration at NASA's Washington headquarters. His area of responsibility includes what are now being called flagship technology missions.
So next question comes from Jeremy Diesel of KHOU Television, Houston.
Thanks for taking the time on this. I think maybe part of the angst is not truly having an understanding of what something as broad and as grandiose a title as flagship technology actually means. Can you give a laundry list? Can you give some examples of what these flagship technologies actually might be in the future?
This is Doug Cook. We are laying out potential concepts for these missions. They would be demonstrating cryo management and fuel storage on orbit, automated rendezvous and docking, perhaps in the same mission. We're looking at flying inflatable habitats. We're looking at potentially flying aero capture missions to help us understand how to aero brake into an atmosphere like Mars, so you don't have to do it propulsively. These are technologies that are mature enough to go test on a big enough scale that you get really good information back so that you can apply it to human missions. So we're looking at what technologies are available for those types of demonstrations and putting them together in a way that gets the most information for the money that we spend on them.
On this evening's space show, we have been listening to recordings I made in April last year at the Kennedy Space Center. NASA officials Charlie Bolden, Laurie Garber, and Doug Cook have been outlining the new tasks being assigned to NASA's various centers. On our next space show, Robert Cabana, the director of the Kennedy Space Center, will describe the role his center will play in America's space future. You can view pictures and read the story of my visit to the Kennedy Space Center on Southern FM's website. Visit www.southernfm.com/space. So that's www. Southern FM is one word lowercase, southernfm.com, and then /space. And then from there you can head to the Florida Diary section. And on that website you can also download podcasts of some of our previous programs.